Tick.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, for most of us, the sound of that clock on the wall, it just fades into the background. Your brain filters it out as useless information.
Totally normal.
But imagine if, with every single tick, it felt like someone was physically flicking you hard on the forehead.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Or imagine you're sitting in your kitchen. You hear the faint, low hum of your refrigerator. And instead of just ignoring it, this wave of intense, uncontrollable rage washes over you.
Oh.
Your heart rate spikes, your fists clench, and your body prepares for life or death fight over refrigerator.
I mean, it sounds exhausting just to conceptualize.
Right.
But for a significant portion of the population, that isn't a thought experiment. It's just a Tuesday.
Yeah.
The mundane, everyday sounds of the world are essentially weaponized against them by their own nervous system.
And that is exactly what we are focusing on for today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We're looking at a really illuminating presentation by Professor Ali A. Dinesh from Florida Atlantic University.
Right. His work is incredible.
It really is.
Yeah.
His work focuses on decreased sound tolerance, specifically how it manifests within autism spectrum disorders, or ASD. And we're going to explore two major conditions today, hyperacusis and misophonia.
And, you know, Professor Dinesh's research is so comprehensive because it bridges a really crucial gap.
How so?
Well, it connects the behavioral symptoms we see on the outside, like the flinching, the anger, the isolation, with the hard physical biology happening deep within the ear and the neural pathways of the brain.
So our mission today is to uncover those biological and genetic reasons why certain brains process sound so intensely.
Exactly.
We're going to examine the hidden emotional toll this takes on daily life. And then we're going to explore the highly counterintuitive therapies being used to physically rewire the brain's relationship with sound. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Before we can fix the problem, we need to understand exactly what you or someone you love might be experiencing. We have to define these two very different forms of decreased sound tolerance.
Yeah. So let's start with hyperacusis. This is a general overarching sensitivity to sound.
Okay.
It is quite literally as if the volume dial of the entire environment is broken and just stuck on maximum.
So everything is loud.
Everything. Every day, noises, traffic on the street, a vacuum cleaner two rooms away, even just water running in the sink, they're all perceived as uncomfortably loud.
Wow.
And in severe cases, they cause acute physical pain.
Which is very different from the second condition, misophonia. Because if hyperacusis is about the volume dial being broken, misophonia is more about the channel you're tuned into.
That's a great way to distinguish them, because misophonia is triggered by highly specific sounds.
Right.
And it triggers an intense emotional or physiological response.
Yeah.
We're talking about profound anger or disgust.
And it's usually human sounds, right?
Almost always human-generated sounds. Someone chewing their food, heavy breathing, the repetitive clicking of a pen, or typing on a keyboard.
The keyboard typing.
Right. And the actual decibel level of the sound doesn't matter at all. It's the pattern and the source of the noise that instantly hijacks the person's nervous system.
Now, the research points out something deeply compelling about how this interacts with autism spectrum disorder. Because people with ASD often have entirely different sensory profiles, but we usually only hear about the deficits.
That's true, yeah.
But Professor Dinesh's data highlights that autistic individuals often have perceptual differences that are actually superior to neurotypical adults.
Yes, they do.
They frequently have superior perception of pitch, a highly superior ability to identify musical notes, and incredible local processing of auditory stimuli.
They are receiving and analyzing acoustic data from the world with incredible precision. But, you know, that level of precision comes with a severe cost when your neurological filter isn't functioning the same way.
Right.
You capture all the brilliant details of symphony, sure, but you also capture the agonizing screech of the subway brakes with the exact same level of hyperfocus.
It's like having an auditory superpower you didn't ask for. You get the superior ability to identify a B-flat in a crowded room, but the cruel trade-off is that the whole world is essentially shouting at you all day long.
Yeah.
And the prevalence of this in the ASD community is just staggering. In the general population, studies show hyperacusis ranges from around 3.2% to 17.1%.
Which is already significant.
Right. But in the ASD population, those numbers completely skyrocket.
They really do. Professor Dinesh conducted a pivotal survey back in 2015, evaluating individuals with what was then classified as Asperger's syndrome.
Which falls under high-functioning ASD today, right?
Correct. And the results were incredibly striking. 69% of the surveyed individuals reported having hyperacusis.
69%.
Yeah.
That is a massive majority of that population dealing with physical pain from everyday noise.
It is. What's fascinating here is that hyperacusis very rarely exists in a vacuum.
What do you mean?
Well, it frequently co-occurs with other complex medical and psychological conditions, things like PTSD, severe depression, and tinnitus.
Okay.
But among all of those, ASD is the most common comorbid disorder. And we can actually quantify the impact this has on their quality of life.
Oh, so.
In that same 2015 study, the researchers used something called the hyperacusis questionnaire. The average score among the autistic participants was a 20.7.
Okay, let's translate that score into real life for a second. A 20.7 equates to a 50% annoyance level in daily life.
Yeah, half your life.
Just think about your own day. Imagine if half of your waking hours, half of your daily experiences, were fundamentally disrupted or tainted by painful or highly irritating sounds.
You can't function normally.
You can't read in a coffee shop. You can't concentrate in an open plan office. You can't even listen to a friend across a table at a restaurant because the clattering of silverware in the kitchen is drowning them out.
It dictates the perimeter of your life. It dictates where you can go, who you can safely interact with, and what kind of work or education you can realistically participate in.
Wow.
It is a massive, invisible barrier to existing in modern society.
So if the world sounds that incredibly loud and painful to these individuals, the natural question is why? Why is their reality so different?
Right.
Because for a long time, there was this toxic misconception that sensory overload was just a behavioral issue, that kids were acting out or adults were just being, quote unquote, too sensitive. But the biology completely dismantles that myth.
It absolutely does. The anatomical and neurological evidence proves this is a deeply physical phenomenon.
Okay.
Let's look at the physical anatomy of the ear itself. The research highlights a condition called superior semicircular canal dehiscence.
Dehiscence. That implies like a structural gap or a thinning of the tissue, right?
Exactly. It's a tiny literal anatomical anomaly, a thinning or a microscopic hole in the bone of the inner ear.
A hole in the bone.
Yeah. And because of the structural difference, the acoustic energy of a sound doesn't just travel down the normal hearing pathway. It essentially leaks into the vestibular system.
Wait, the vestibular system?
Yeah, that's the system that controls your balance and spatial orientation.
Oh, wow.
So when a door slams, it doesn't just register as a loud noise. It can actually trigger a wave of physical disequilibrium or vertigo.
Wait, so we need to be clear for the listener. This isn't just a behavioral quirk or someone overreacting to a loud noise.
Mm-hmm.
There are literal physical differences in the inner ear bone and specific genetic variants causing this. Audiologists can actually physically measure this structural anomaly, right?
They can. They use something called a VEMP, a vestibular evoked myogenic potential test.
Okay.
It measures the electrical activity of the muscles in your neck and eyes in response to sound.
Ooh, hold on. How does measuring a neck muscle tell you what's happening inside the ear bone?
Because the vestibular system is directly wired to those muscles to keep your head upright and your eyes stable when you move.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if sound is leaking through that tiny hole in the bone and inappropriately stimulating the balance center, the VEMP test will pick up an abnormal electrical spike in the neck muscles.
That is wild.
It really is. By looking at these muscle potentials, doctors can differentiate if a child's hyperacusis is caused by this specific physical dehiscence or if it's due to general immaturity of the ear bones.
That is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And the structural differences don't stop at the bone. The sources talk about a phenomenon called central gain enhancement.
Right. This is where we move from the hardware of the ear to the software of the brain.
Okay.
Think of the brain's auditory pathway as having an internal volume dial, or gain. If the brain feels it isn't getting enough auditory input, perhaps because the person is constantly wearing earplugs to protect themselves.
Which makes sense.
Right. But it will actively turn up that internal gain to go hunting for the missing signal.
It's like turning a stereo amplifier all the way up when no music is playing. You just get this overwhelmingly loud, aggressive static hiss. The brain turns up the volume to find a signal, but it ends up amplifying everything, making normal sounds agonizing.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. Furthermore, the auditory cortex, the actual region of the brain that processes sound, it physically reorganizes its structure in response to this.
Really?
Yeah. The tonotopic map, which is how the brain geographically maps out different sound frequencies, physically changes its layout.
So the brain is physically remodeling itself to be more sensitive.
Exactly.
And this ties into the physical defense mechanisms of the ear failing too, right?
Yeah.
Because the research details something called the stapedial acoustic reflex.
Yes. Inside your ear, there is a tiny muscle called the stapedius.
Okay.
In a neurotypical ear, when a sudden loud noise happens, like a balloon popping, this muscle instantly contracts. It stiffens the tiny bones in the middle ear, dampening the vibration and protecting the delicate inner ear from damage.
So it's a reflex.
It's an automatic, instantaneous defense mechanism.
I picture it like the pupil of an eye. You walk out of a dark movie theater into the bright sunlight, and your pupil instantly constricts to protect your retina.
Yes, very similar.
But what Professor Dinesh's data shows is that in autistic individuals, there is a measurable delay in this stapedial reflex.
That's the critical issue. The reflex happens, but it's too late.
So to use the eye analogy, it would be like walking out of that dark theater into the blinding sun, but your pupil is on a 5-second delay.
Exactly.
You are completely blinded and in pain before your body even tries to protect you. The loud sound blasts through the ear with full force before the stapedius muscle can brace for impact.
That's exactly what is happening mechanically. And we also see fundamental differences in something called DPOAE's distortion product otoacoustic emissions.
Which sounds incredibly complex, but the concept is actually beautiful. Is the ear making its own sound?
It is. When sound enters a healthy functioning inner ear, the microscopic sensory hair cells vibrate. And as they process the sound, they actually produce their own extremely faint echoing sounds back out into the ear canal.
Wow.
Yeah, and audiologists can put a tiny microphone in the ear and measure those echoes to ensure the inner ear is mechanically healthy. In individuals with ASD, those echo amplitudes are often reduced.
Which means what exactly?
It suggests that the mechanical biological regulation of sound within the cochlea itself is operating atypically.
And driving all of this, the delayed reflexes, the bone structures, the central gain is a genetic foundation. The research highlights clinical investigations into specific genes, particularly contact and gene variants like CNTN5 and CNTN6.
Right. Those specific genes are responsible for neural wiring and the development of neural networks.
Okay.
Variants in CNTN5 and CNTN6 have been clinically linked to hypersensitivity to sounds. They actually cause measurable changes in the latency of brainwaves within the auditory pathway.
So deeply wired in.
Extremely. We're tracking this from the DNA to the structural development of the inner ear bones, to the delayed muscle reflexes, to the brain's physical cortex remodeling itself. This is a deeply, undeniably biological reality.
So if your biology is hardwired from the genetic level to amplify sound, and your ear's physical defense mechanisms are perpetually a step behind, how does that actually manifest in your emotional life?
It's severe.
Yeah, that brings us to the psychological reality,
mm-hmm.
particularly the intense emotional toll of misophonia.
The emotional response is really what sets misophonia apart from hyperacusis. It isn't just pain, it's a hijacking of the emotional regulation center.
Okay.
A 2020 study by Yeager looked deeply at this dynamic. When triggered by specific sounds, like someone chewing or breathing heavily, the emotional reactions are severe and instantly disruptive.
How severe?
Well, 89.5% of individuals experience intense anger. 64% experience profound disgust.
Disgust is such a visceral reaction.
It is.
It isn't just being annoyed. Feeling profound disgust because someone a few desks over is chewing gum means your brain is interpreting that sound almost like a biological contaminant.
Exactly.
Your amygdala, your brain's threat detection center, is entirely bypassing your rational, logical brain.
Yeah.
You can't just ignore disgust or rage. It triggers a massive fight-or-flight adrenaline dump.
And living in a constant state of fight-or-flight leads to massive avoidance behaviors. You start subconsciously mapping your world around potential triggers.
Right, because you want to avoid the pain.
Yes. You avoid family dinners because the sound of chewing is unbearable. You avoid public transit. You drop out of certain classrooms. The comorbidity with other psychiatric disorders here is immense.
Like what?
Misophonia frequently co-occurs with severe anxiety, depression, and OCD. In youth, it causes severe impairment in their daily functioning. They're highly distressed, but often they're suffering in complete silence.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because there is an absolute invisible epidemic happening around us, particularly in academic settings.
Absolutely.
The research highlights a 2019 study by Porcaro, which looked at the environment right at Florida Atlantic University. An earlier study had found that roughly 20% of undergraduate students self-report experiencing clinical signs of misophonia.
That's 1 in 5 students.
1 in 5. But when the researchers surveyed the instructors at the university, The instructors reported that only 2.3% of students ever actually disclose it.
That discrepancy is the core of the tragedy. You have a massive gap between the internal suffering of the students and the external awareness of the people running the environment.
Yeah.
It means you have lecture halls where a significant portion of the students are absolutely white-knuckling their way through a 90-minute class.
Just trying to survive.
Yes. They are expending massive amounts of cognitive energy just trying to suppress their fight or flight response to a classmate clicking a pen, and they are completely hiding it from their professors.
Why do you think they hide it so fiercely? Is it just the stigma, the fear of sounding unreasonable?
Mostly, yes.
Because if you walk up to a professor and say, "Excuse me, the way the person next to me is breathing is making me want to scream and break my desk," it sounds completely irrational if neither of you knows the biology behind it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the barrier here isn't a lack of empathy from educators, it's a complete lack of awareness.
That makes sense.
The Porcaro study found something incredibly optimistic, actually. When academics and educators were actually presented with the biological data about misophonia, they were highly willing to change their classroom behaviors and offer robust accommodations.
Well, that's great.
Dissemination of information is the absolute bottleneck. Once a professor understands that this is a neurological condition involving the amygdala and central gain enhancement, the willingness to help is immediately there.
So understanding the biology is step one, but what comes next? If you are suffering in silence with a biologically rooted condition, what can actually be done to treat it?
Let's talk about management.
Right, because the most effective treatments are highly counterintuitive. Let's dive into the management strategies.
First, we should briefly touch on medication. The pharmacological management of hyperacusis and misophonia, particularly in ASD, is not well established.
Okay, so no magic pill.
Right. There's some clinical evidence that a medication called risperidone has shown potential in reducing irritability in certain cases, but it's not a silver bullet. The vast majority of effective long-term management relies on non-pharmacological approaches.
Specifically, sound therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. Let's look at the habituation training outlined by Professor Dinesh and his colleagues.
Okay.
This is fascinating because the goal isn't to fix the ear bone. It's to literally retrain the brain's non-classical auditory pathway. How does the physical retraining work?
It's a highly structured, systemic desensitization process. First, you enrich the person's auditory system with pleasant sounds.
Like music.
Yeah, you create custom soundtracks of music or nature sounds that they actually find soothing and enjoyable. You start playing these sounds at a very, very low volume, almost at the threshold of hearing. And over the course of weeks and months, you gradually, almost imperceptibly, increase the volume.
You're sneaking the sound past their brain's threat detector.
Exactly. The goal is to slowly rebuild the brain's physical tolerance and gently turn down that central gain amplifier without triggering the automatic fearful response to the noise.
But there is a massive catch to this therapy, a rule of desensitization that is going to sound completely backwards, almost cruel, to anyone who has ever dealt with severe sensory overload.
It is tough to hear.
The research explicitly states that a crucial part of the treatment is the reduction of unnecessary ear protection.
Yes, the tactical, deliberate weaning off of earplugs and heavy ear defenders.
So what does this all mean? Hold on. Telling someone who experiences actual, measurable physical pain from sound to take off their earplugs sounds like torture.
I know.
How do you convince a patient, especially an autistic child, to do that without completely overwhelming their nervous system?
It requires immense trust, a very gradual timeline, and a deep understanding of how neuroplasticity works. You don't just rip the headphones off in a crowded cafeteria.
Right.
Initially, using noise-canceling headphones is perfectly fine. It's necessary for self-protection and survival. But remember that central gain enhancement we talked about earlier.
The brain turning up the amplifier because it's starved for signal.
Right. If you constantly wear heavy earplugs, your brain notices the severe drop in auditory input. What does it do? It panics.
Oh.
It turns the internal volume dial up even higher to compensate for the earplugs. So when you eventually do take the earplugs out to take a shower or go to sleep, the world sounds even more agonizingly loud and sharp than it did before.
It is awful.
Overprotecting the ear actually physically worsens the hyperacusis over time.
Yeah.
You trap yourself in a neurological feedback loop.
The more you block out the sound, the more sensitive your brain becomes to it.
Yeah.
You are accidentally training your brain to be hypervigilant.
Yeah.
So you have to systematically re-expose the brain in safe environments so it learns that it can turn its own internal amplifier back down.
And we are seeing really interesting technological bridges to help with this transition.
Like what?
A 2024 study by Zanin looked at children with autism using modern, commercially available noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds in the classroom, as opposed to those massive, highly visible industrial ear defenders.
The big, bulky ones that immediately single a kid out and scream, "I have a sensory issue."
Precisely. The social stigma of those large defenders causes immense anxiety, which only heightens the overall nervous system arousal.
Makes total sense.
The study found that while the discrete Bluetooth earbuds didn't necessarily enhance the children's ability to perceive speech in a noisy room, they significantly improved their overall auditory attention and classroom behavior.
Because they're not self-conscious.
Right. It offers a much less stigmatizing alternative. It gives them a manageable layer of protection to survive the school day, which can then be paired with clinical therapies to gradually build their natural tolerance back up.
And building that natural tolerance brings us to the psychological side of the rewiring CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy. Because it's not just about the mechanics of the ear, it's about the catastrophic thoughts attached to the sound.
Yes. CBT aims to modify the irrational thoughts and the safety-seeking behaviors associated with the noise.
Okay.
The research points out that while there are limited large-scale studies specifically looking at CBT for hyperacusis and autistic individuals, there is highly relevant adjacent data.
Like what kind of data?
Well, a 2019 study by Stort showed that CBT is highly effective for treating general anxiety in autistic early adolescents.
So the implication is profound. If CBT can successfully rewire the rigid anxiety pathways in an autistic brain, it has incredibly strong potential to rewire the fear and distress pathways associated with hyperacusis and misophonia.
Exactly.
You aren't just talking about your feelings. You work with a psychologist or an audiologist, you track your physical distress levels in a diary, and you do deliberate behavioral experiments.
It's very hands-on.
You physically prove to your brain that the sound of a ticking clock, while highly annoying, is not an actual biological threat to your safety.
It's about moving toward radical acceptance of the symptoms, removing the panic response, and allowing your brain's natural neuroplasticity to do its work.
Wow.
You basically break the link between the auditory cortex and the fight or flight response of the amygdala.
We've covered incredible ground today. We started by understanding the sheer, overwhelming physical volume of hyperacusis and the intense, targeted disgust of misophonia.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. We moved beneath the surface to uncover the real genetic variants, the literal microscopic holes in the inner ear bone, and the delayed muscle reflexes that cause this pain.
Yeah.
And finally, we explored how the incredible power of neuroplasticity through gradual sound habituation and cognitive therapy offers a real biological path forward out of the silence.
It really is a perfect example of how complex the human nervous system is and how heavily intertwined our physical mechanical senses are with our emotional realities.
And to you listening right now, this is why diving into this science matters. It isn't just medical trivia. Armed with this understanding, you can fundamentally change how you view the people around you.
Absolutely.
Empathy is so much easier when it's built on a foundation of biological reality. That colleague who flinches at the coffee machine, the classmate who always wears earbuds and sits in the back, or the family member who has to suddenly leave the loud dinner table, they aren't being difficult.
They're just trying to survive.
Right. They aren't acting out. Their brain is actively amplifying the world, and they are doing their best to navigate a reality that is fundamentally louder than yours.
This raises an important question, one that really lingers when you look at all this data on habituation and central gain.
What's that?
Well, if the brain can physically reorganize its auditory cortex to make everyday sounds painful, and then remarkably be trained out of that pain by physically remodeling those pathways again through gradual exposure, what does that imply about our brain's ability to tune our other senses?
Oh, wow. If the auditory map can be redrawn, what about touch or vision or taste?
Exactly. Are we all walking around living in highly customized, deeply plastic sensory realities? And if so, if we really understood the mechanisms of neuroplasticity, could we theoretically recalibrate our other senses at will?
That is wild to think about.
The boundary between what we objectively perceive in the world and what our brain is actively constructing for us is so much more flexible than we think.
That is absolutely something to chew on. So the next time you hear the ticking of a clock or the faint hum of a refrigerator, take a moment to appreciate the incredibly complex myological filter that is managing that sound for you. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you.